Welcome into another edition of Be Conscious. I'm Damian Barling. I'm so happy you're here. If you didn't get the opportunity to listen to the brief little podcast we posted yesterday, I'm really excited for today. I'm really excited for this week. If you're downloading this episode the day that it came out, it's October 16th, 2018. I posted this podcast on October 16th, 2018. It is the 50th anniversary of Tommy Smith and John Carlos on top of the victory stand at the 1968 Olympic Games. And again, if you missed our introductory podcast yesterday, David Steele of the Sporting News, he helped write Tommy Smith's autobiography, Silent Gesture. He's going to join us here in just a heartbeat. And later on this week, Karan J. Phillips of the New York Daily News, he's been a guest on Be Conscious before. He's going to join me as well as he wrote a column last week about the impact of Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the landscape of sports in the 60s and how that relates to where we are today. So it's a unique week. This is an event and a moment in sports that I have been fascinated by since I first learned about it. I think back in 1992, and it's something I've read a lot about, studied a lot about, and I'm excited to talk to David here. So we're going to bring in David Steele of the Sporting News again. He helped write Tommy Smith's autobiography, Silent Gesture. And David, I've been trying to figure out where to start this conversation, and I think the best way to start is we're 125 miles from San Jose State University. There's a big statue of Tommy Smith and John Carlos out there. What impact did San Jose State have on Tommy Smith?
I think in a lot of ways it was a completely new world for him, because the way he grew up, college was sort of this faraway vision. It was something that really didn't seem all that realistic. The family was something that his family all wanted. And he grew up in Central California. His family were farm workers. The closest thing to sharecropping as you could have back in the 1940s or 50s. So they were really, really poor, and the parents wanted much, much more for him and his brothers and sisters than they already had. So they wanted to get they wanted college for them and as much education as they could. And a lot of his siblings, like him, ended up getting a good education. But once they actually got through high school and got to college and got into the world of San Jose State, you know, so big, so urban, mm-hmm. and so not reflective of what he had been used to, it was really kind of an eye opener for him. So he was there. Obviously, his number one goal was to get an education, but his path to get there was to be an athlete. So he had to get to juggle that, and he was also there, obviously, as a sort of a representative of Black people, because the only Black students at San Jose State and a lot of California schools, period, were the athletes. They were the only Black students on campus. So that was an experience for him as well. He had very few Black instructors and professors. So it was something new almost every day for him in terms of the experiences he was sort of collecting as he sort of moved along his path there at San Jose State.
One thing I really, it was glaring in your book, but I noticed it in the time that I've studied Tommy Smith and read about him, was he was one of the fastest men in the world. Like, he was on his way to being a massive track star before the 68 Olympics got here.
He was an absolute superstar. And it's funny, I try to give him some sort of contemporary comparison in the years since I had the opportunity to write the book. And I've said he was sort of like Michael Johnson. He was sort of like Usain Bolt. He was sort of like a lot of different Carl Lewis in a way. But realistically, as the buildup grew for 1968, he was even bigger than all of them. I mean, it was going to be an absolute monster U.S. track and field team that was going to go to Mexico City. And he was the biggest name there. And he was coming from a program that was legendary. And he became the signature runner on that San Jose State program, was nicknamed Speed City. And they'd been sending sprinters to the Olympics for a decade already by the time Tommy Smith got there and sort of grew to prominence. He came pretty close to making it in 1964 in Tokyo. And then by the time he had gone through all the preliminaries leading up to 1968 and the trials and everything, he was as well known as any sprinter on the planet. And he was poised to be, you know, just, he was going to get the entire treatment, the Wheaties boxes and the endorsements and the big name. And he was going to go down in history with like the Rafer Johnsons and all the guys, the Jesse Owenses. He was going to break all sorts of, because, and remember, this, what made him stand out was that he was dominant in multiple distances. Mm-hmm. I mean, he held 11 world records at one time, and there a lot of them were world records that we don't contest anymore, but it was like the 100 meters and 100 yards, 200 meters, 220 yards, the 400, the 440, the relays, the straightaways, the curves. It was just this incredible collection of challenges to his dominance, and he was mastering every single one of them. He was going to just roll through the Olympics and just become an absolute megastar.
And I think that's so important to point out, because when people look at it in history, they look at, oh, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, those are the guys on the medal stand. Yeah, they did that thing in 68 and then they went away forever. Like, no, they didn't go away. Like, they were in the prime of their careers and then they were sent away from track and field forever.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That has to be distinguished, because clearly they were both in position at that time. And obviously it's weird that we, you know, think of, you know, John Carlos, he quote unquote only finished third in that race. And if you get a chance to see the race, and I highly recommend anybody to see that race, it's a really spectacular race for a 200 meter dash. It's as thrilling and riveting as any race you've ever seen. Those two guys could have gone on in 72, maybe even gone on in 76. You know, the changes in training methods and things like that were starting already to sort of extend the athletes' lives. The whole amateurism business hadn't caught up to it yet, of course. Mm-hmm. So it might have been difficult for them to sort of sustain a living all that time. But certainly, had they solely been judged on their track ability alone, those guys were going to go down in Olympic history anyway. They were going to clean up there. They were going to be superstars there. They're going to be stars of that entire team there. And then, more likely than not, they were going to be back in 72 and repeat the same thing. So, yeah, they, you know, that all came to an end after a protest. I mean, a complete end. I mean, they were absolutely done in the Olympic and the track and field world. I mean, nobody, you know, as much as they were admired in certain corners by the people who were, you know, sort of supporting what they were doing, the track and field world itself just shut it down completely. And the Olympic movement completely just shut it all down. It was over for them from that moment on.
And I think to truly understand the importance of that moment on the victory stand 50 years ago, you have to kind of take yourself back to the 60s and, you know, Malcolm X being murdered in 65 and Dr. King in 68. Robert Kennedy was in 68. Also, the Freedom Riders, the lunch sit-ins and all those sorts of different things. That group formed in, you know, with Dr. Harry Edwards, and we'll talk more about him in a minute, with Tommy Smith and that group there. What was the original intention of that demonstration on the victory stand?
Well, what's really funny about that, and we probably will talk about this more at length, is that the original intention was for them not to be there at all.
Yeah.
The black athletes from the United States were going to boycott the games.
And you know, that was, it would probably make sense to get into that right now. That's the Olympic Project for Human Rights that you're referring to.
Right. And that's what that was. The Olympic Project for Human Rights, the goal of, and there were many goals that they wanted to achieve there, but their main avenue for achieving all those goals was to make as big a statement as possible on the biggest stage possible, which was the 1968 games. So the original intent was to boycott the games. When they reached the conclusion that they would not do that, they sort of collectively decided, everybody make their own decision and make it whenever you feel comfortable doing it. You know, we're not going to put a mandate on this. We're not going to put pressure on you. You know, if you win a medal, or if you take the field, or if you get in the starting blocks, and you don't do something or don't say anything or don't make any sort of gesture, statement, or anything like that, we're not going to hold it against you. We're not going to pressure you. But at the same time, if you feel you are going to do something, you know, you have the freedom and the flexibility and the sort of approval of sort of the entire group to go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something they decided before, you know, all the athletes went to the games. And this applied across the board, not just the track and field team, but everybody. The basketball team, you know, the boxers, everybody, you know, all had that option. So once the track competition started, and that's where the obviously the highest concentration of black athletes were, certainly from the United States, it was then just a matter of watching and waiting for which athletes were going to do something. And just sort of as it turned out, the 200 meter final was going to be one of the premier events of the games, even bigger than the 100, mm-hmm. which is kind of hard to believe, but that's just how it was set up that year, because they knew, you know, that Tommy Smith and John Carlos were such big names. They wanted to put that in the biggest, you know, into the biggest window possible for the biggest number of viewers and biggest attendance there in the stadium. So it just sort of fell to them.
And it, you know, as we mentioned the OPHR right there, and you mentioned some of the demands that they had. One of them was the reinstatement of Muhammad Ali as the world heavyweight boxing champion. And I found that so amazing, because as I just started to think more and more about this, and, you know, obviously there's been a lot of reflection on activism and athletes with Colin Kaepernick and you know, some of the WNBA teams and LeBron and all these different types of issues. And I think, and this is obviously a subjective question, David, but it's something that popped in my head, is Muhammad Ali refusing induction into the U.S. Army the most important moment in sports history?
I think you can make a great case for it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when and it's kind of ironic, because the phrase that has sort of stuck to Ali and always will was "I shook up the world," and that was years before when he beat Sonny Liston.
Yeah,
that shook things up more than anything anybody could remember before that or after that. And we're talking about the whole Jesse Owens winning in front of Hitler and Joe Louis, you know, knocking out Max Schmeling, and just Jackie Robinson making his debut, and just all the things you can remember as the more or less milestones of black advancement that sort of crossed over into the wider society. Nothing shook this country and what it viewed itself to be down to its foundations more than the heavyweight champion of the world, this poor black kid that had sort of, you know, become this celebrity in ways that really hadn't been seen in boxing before. He's just this totally unique personality and character, and his, you know, his influence was spreading all over the place. For him to refuse to fight for his country the way Joe Louis did, and the way, you know, you can just name all these other, you know, athletes who, you know, quote unquote, prove their patriotism and their love for their country despite its treatment of them and all those sort of things. For him to refuse and to do it on the grounds that he did, and to sort of make the statements that he did, and to tell people, this is the name I'm using and you better start using it, because I will not answer you if you call me by my given name. Yeah, it's on so many levels, it's hard for us to comprehend it. I'm guessing I'm a little bit older than you. It's hard for me to comprehend it.
Yeah.
I was just practically a baby when mm-hmm. all that happened. I mean, when I became aware of Ali, he was already Ali. There were obviously generations before me who only knew of him as Cassius Clay, and they were going to go to their graves only calling him Cassius Clay. Mm-hmm. And they weren't going to call him Muhammad Ali if someone had put a gun to their head. I mean, and you also, again, you mentioned Malcolm X's assassination. Just the influence and the image and the view of the Nation of Islam within the context of the civil rights movement and within black America and in America as a whole, to have all that encapsulated in really one moment, even as much as people were anticipating that it might happen, when it actually did happen, and everybody moved so quickly to just yank his championship away and exile him for however long it took, they would have been perfectly happy if he never fought again. I mean, and as you're hearing, think of the echoes you're hearing now.
Yeah, I was just about to say the same thing. It's so amazing that you're talking about something that happened 50 years ago that could easily, you could change a few words, change a sport, and you're talking about something that we're regularly speaking about right now.
Yeah. So, and I think what's kind of funny about that is that one of the first reactions a lot of people had to Colin Kaepernick was, this is as brave as what Ali did. And there was immediate backlash to that, say, don't you ever put him in the same category as Ali. It's like, you're already forgetting that back then, that's exactly how Ali was. Exactly what the reaction to Ali was that he needed to be banned.
He was hated.
Not only his sport, but from society.
Yeah.
From American society. Unless he, showed remorse and paid his amends and, stepped forward and obeyed orders and did what was required of him and, accepted the fate that was prescribed for him.
I mean, you look at so many of these figures from the 60s, Ali being one of them, and, people don't like to acknowledge this, but Dr. King is one as well, and Tommy Smith also. The narrative on them is completely changed. And we talked, I had this very conversation with Howard Bryant on an earlier episode of this podcast. He wrote The Heritage, and it's, people want to be on the right side of history, and they realize Ali was right, and Tommy Smith was right, and Dr. King was right. So now, as 50 years have gone by, we're going to change the narrative and shape them out to be these heroes, which they very much weren't back then.
they absolutely were not. And it's funny because every once in a while, you'll see, and it's part of the age we're in. We're sort of in the social media age. It's an instant reaction, and people are sort of pushing people's buttons to instantly, comment on one thing or another. So some athlete will do something crazy. Michael Vick will do something, or Ray Lewis will do something. LeBron James will do something. Somebody will say, oh, he's got to be the most hated athlete of all time. And you go, ding, 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 ding. Not even close.
Yeah. Yeah, not even close.
To understand the depth of the hatred of Muhammad Ali, it's really unfathomable to people today. And the same went for Tommy and John back then. When they did that, I mean, they were honestly public enemy 1A immediately. And they carried that around, and they faced that, and they confronted that literally from that moment on. Because, I mean, they'll both tell you that as much as they tried to, tune out, what was going on around them as they stood on that victory stand, they heard the boos, mm-hmm. and they felt the tension in the stands and on that field. And as they came down off the steps, they really weren't sure what might happen. From there to underneath the stands.
Yeah, what was Tommy Smith thinking in those moments as he raised his fist and put his head down on that podium?
He just said he just told himself that he was going to do it with the most perfect form as he possibly could. Mm-hmm. That he was going to keep his mind focused on what he was doing, why he was doing it. Sort of keep a prayer in his mind, keep his composure in mind, but also to be prepared for whatever might happen at any moment during the course of the anthem. And that, honestly, he has said that included somebody killing him.
Mm-hmm.
Firing a gun from the stands, somebody yanking him off the podium, in mid song. It really literally could have been anything. So he just felt that, and part of it was he didn't want to give anyone any reason to denigrate him for any other reason besides the actual act he was doing. So he wasn't going to be, sloppy about the way he was standing. He was going to be, rigidly straight, fist in the air, shoes, feet pointing and saying, of course, he was barefoot. I remember that. So feet pointing straight out and just this perfectly almost military pose. And to keep his head lowered and to close his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what he focused on. But, he knew, by the time he crossed the finish line, that in light of the fact that nobody else had done anything yet, protest wise, that he was going to do something right then and there.
You know, you mentioned the bare feet, and I think that's something that's often forgotten, is that they went out there with the, you know, socks, bare feet, the shoes were by their side, they had beads around their neck, and then, you know, everyone remembers the black gloves and the fist, which I didn't know until reading Silent Gesture, your book with Tommy Smith, that wasn't necessarily a black power salute.
It was not. And, that's sort of a reminder of the nuances and distinctions of the protest movement, the civil rights movement or the human rights movement in this country back then. They weren't necessarily black power activists. Mm-hmm. You know, they were, and he'll tell you this constantly. And it was the name of the organization, the Olympic Project for Human Rights.
Yeah.
You know, the fist had a different meaning than what the black power activists usually used it for when they had the fist in the air. But clearly, it was perfectly suited for the kind of protest that they wanted to do. That they wanted to do it, obviously, during the national anthem and when the eyes of the world was focused on nothing but them. And as the flag was being raised in a venue like that, with the whole world watching, You know, he has always termed it as a human rights salute rather than a black power salute. And I think that they both had a pretty good understanding of semantics, of the implications of how they phrased things. They were both really pretty careful with their words. Probably Tommy a little more than John was. Just that's the nature of their personalities a little bit.
That was something that really stood out in the book, too, is the way Tommy talked about John Carlos and the way that he talks and how different those two are. One quote that really stood out from the book, because I would, as I had noted to you, I was just really enamored with this part about it not being a black power salute, was a line, the Olympic Project for Human Rights was about all humanity, even those that deny us ours. And that line really, really, really stood out to me. As he was talking about it not being a black power salute.
That's one of the reasons it's resonated to as many people around the world as it has. And that's why both of them have become such figures of note around the world. That's why they spend their all these years traveling and speaking in other countries, probably more so you know, internationally than they even do here. But, you know, the emphasis he wanted to put on it is that, you know, this is exactly what's being taken away from us here in the United States mm-hmm. by this society, by so many elements of it. You know, obviously it wasn't just the U.S. government, wasn't just the state government, wasn't just California, wasn't just, you know, the athletic world, the Olympic world. Wasn't even just San Jose State. It was even just the structure of, you know, being able to go to class and live your life and get the education that you feel you're entitled to there in college. It's just the entire scope of what it means to be a human being and how they were having that taken away from them. And that was sort of the central theme of everything they did and everything they said. And by saying it that way, they felt that they had a connection with a lot of people around the world. I mean, certainly including there in Mexico. You know, they both spoke a lot about that as well because, you know, they clearly had a lot of support in Mexico and the Mexican government because of the way they were sort of policing the city and that area during the games. You know, they did some pretty heinous stuff as well. So that's why he continued to emphasize human rights, and why he said that's what the protest was all about for the exact reason that he stated in the book.
I mentioned the name Dr. Harry Edwards a little bit ago. Can you tell me how those two connected and what role Dr. Edwards played in what went on in Mexico City?
Well, Dr. Edwards was a teacher at San Jose State. He was a former athlete. So he understood the athletics dynamic. He understood the campus dynamic and how the two intersected and the educational dynamic as well. So he's there not only teaching classes on sociology and, you know, getting, you know, advanced degrees, sociology, and bringing it to the scant number of black athletes in college, and certainly there at San Jose State at the time, but also to the athletes themselves. So he was in a position to constantly advise, you know, the athletes as they came along, and he'd been doing it for a few years, and they're really roughly the same age. And so Tommy and John, when John arrived there as well, they were very impressed with somebody as young as he was doing as much as he was in, you know, in a venue like that, in higher education, and they're doing it there in Northern California as well. And they just sort of gravitated toward each other. And so there was sort of a natural match for each other when they started discussing what they would do when it was time to when it's time to go to the Olympics in the ensuing years. So once Dr. Edwards started becoming very vocal about it, he knew that he had somebody who was going to be very supportive in Tommy Smith, and somebody who was going to be a center of attention as the Olympics approached. So every time he, you know, win another race, win another award, set another world record, people would come flocking to him, do a newspaper or a magazine or a TV or a radio interview with him. They would talk about the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And the word started to get out. People began to know what they were trying to do. They began to know who Harry Edwards was. Eventually they knew who Tommy Smith and Lee Evans and all the other athletes there at San Jose State who were going to be stars on the Olympic team. And they all sort of came together, and Harry was just the guy sort of overseeing it all, shaping it all, and putting it all in sort of putting it all in place and letting the athletes have the opportunity to spread the word.
I don't feel like it was said in the book, or it wasn't said in the book, but I felt like it was kind of implied. And please correct me if I'm wrong. Did Tommy feel like, once 68 came and went, once the Olympics came and went, that Dr. Edwards used him to get a message out? And then just kind of, that was kind of it after that?
Did a good job picking up on that, yeah. And I kind of get the sense that most people who read that kind of understood that as well. Because Tommy was, again, and we've sort of mentioned this a few times, he wasn't a guy who was really out there sort of being expressive. I mean, he would talk when asked questions, but he wasn't a guy who was fully confident of himself when he stood up and, you know, emoted in public, not the way that Dr. Edwards or John Carlos were. But when he had something to say, he made sure he said it. Yeah, made sure he said it pretty clearly. And so his beliefs aligned with Dr. Edwards. But one of the things that has sort of caused this sort of generational tension that sort of carried on past the decades was that Harry Edwards was sort of positioning himself as the leader of the movement and of the project, and he was sort of the voice of it and the face of it, even with, you know, the athletes of Tommy Smith caliber being there. But when push came to shove to actually go down to Mexico City and face the music, Harry Edwards wasn't there.
Yeah,
and you know, the reason that was given was that, hey, you know, it was dangerous. My life would have been in danger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Tommy Smith was like, well, what do you think was going on with us?
Yeah.
Same was going on with our lives. I mean, yeah. We were right there in the crosshairs for everybody. You could have been as well. You know, we both had this big bushel of letters and hate mail and threats and things like that from various people all across the country and around the world coming toward us, you know. I went down there, John went down there, we faced it, you know, literally, and Harry Edwards wasn't there. And in the ensuing years, Harry Edwards was the guy who went from professor to doctor, who became, you know, the lecturer, the published author, and who was, you know, sort of who sought out all the time to sort of voice and articulate the movement and the role in it and what happened in 68 and those sort of things. And in a big way, Tommy and John were sort of left to their own devices. And they both clearly, in a lot of different ways, struggle with their lives in the aftermath of that for various reasons.
Yeah. And you, that book with Silent Gesture that you and Tommy did together, it's just that aspect of his life is laid out incredibly. And So was the part with John Carlos, because, you know, you just laid out his relationship, Tommy's relationship with Dr. Harry Edwards. And, you know, Tommy and John are linked together, you know, here on the 50th anniversary of that iconic moment forever. But the two really don't have a relationship.
They don't. Yeah, they come together when the moment calls for it. And a lot of moments over the last 50 years have called for it. Obviously, they're constantly asked to speak and win awards and do panels and things like that. And I've personally seen them together in a bunch of places, you know, over the years, including this year. Obviously, they'll be, you know, right down the road from you this week, commemorating everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, one of the big things of the book itself was the dedication of that statue. So they'll be joined again. But one thing they both have emphasized constantly is that they're two very, very different people, and they're the kind of personalities that you really would expect them to rub against each other the wrong way. And over the course of time, they have. It's gotten kind of ugly at times. You know, there have been times where they've avoided each other. There are times when they've come in contact with each other and have almost come to blows. There's been shoves. There's been name calling. There's been stuff that's gotten published. There's been stuff that's been said behind people's backs. There have been projects that have not been able to ever come to fruition because they can't agree on stuff. I mean, those of us who have been in their circles, and of course, you know, there have been books written about and by John Carlos over the years as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this should have been a movie decades ago.
Yeah.
This should have been a movie, a miniseries. There's all sorts of things that could have been done. And it never happened because the two just they came together for that moment. You know, their mission and their goal was the same. Their path was more similar than it was different. But their personalities were such that they just, you know, they just had issues with each other. And clearly they've said things about each other that have, you know, kind of, you know, poisoned the waters. And it's has made it hard for them to ever come together and be the kind of, you know, have the kind of relationship that I think everybody would want them to have.
Did Tommy have issues with George Foreman?
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
He did.
I mean, a lot of people may not put that together. The 68 Olympics, it's obviously famous for Bob Beamon. It's famous for the salute in which we're talking about right now with Tommy Smith and John Carlos. But that was also George Foreman's Olympics, where he's kind of parading around with American flags and bowing at the, you know, different corners at a time where that obviously wasn't taken very well by everybody involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember a time, you know, after the book was written and hadn't been published and stuff, where you go to events where these guys appear, you know, take Tommy or John or them together. And, you know, of course, there's the little, you know, sort of the vendor area and things like that. And somebody made a joke about, hey, somebody selling George Foreman grills or George Foreman, you know, gear or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they just said, oh, not in this place. No, that's not welcome here. Because, you know, they recognized immediately. And George Foreman has tried to sort of talk his way out of that. And there's been reason to believe that, you know, the whole walking around the ring with the flags in his hand was not his idea, that it was pushed on him by his coaches, or the boxing coaches, who were very, you know, don't rock the boat, you know, old school, don't, you know, do all this militant stuff kind of guys. But he did it anyway. Tommy certainly took it as a jab at what they did. And that's sort of like some sort of counterpoint to get back in white America's good graces. You know, they all saw the impact that he, you know, George Foreman became this universally beloved figure, both at the time and in the later stages of his career, while those guys are still, you know, registering hotels under different names and traveling with security and, you know, getting, you know, hate mail and death threats and, you know, things put in their mailboxes and things like that. And George Foreman was still this, you know, in the minds of many, was the guy who was acting like a quote unquote true American, who was quote unquote again grateful for the opportunity to fight for his country. Now, of course, the flip side of it was, and George Foreman himself has talked about it, is that when he came home, he found out that all the black people in America hated him because they looked at it the same way Tommy Smith did.
Yeah.
It's like, he's been in these guys' eyes. He said, I came home, I thought I would be a hero, and yet I'm looking around, everybody's got Tommy Smith and John Carlos hanging on their wall, and not me. And I'm like, that's how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, I still do 50 years after the fact. You wrote the book. Do you still have a relationship with Tommy?
I do. We stay in touch as often as we can. I have had a chance to see him in person a few times just within the last couple of weeks. I got to attend a banquet for his youth initiative, which is now based in Atlanta. And for a long time, it was based in Southern California because he was living and teaching at Santa Monica College. He and I have talked a lot about where things are today with what he's done and with what the younger athletes are doing, like the Colin Kaepernicks and the other players who have raised a fist during the games and things like that. And I've gotten to meet more and more members of his family. He's got a pretty big family. Mm-hmm. So not that long ago, I met another one of his sons that I had not met before. And he has just been this for all the ways that he feels he has to be guarded and sort of protective of himself because of everything that he's gone through. He is really such an open and such a generous person. He likes talking about it, and he likes letting you know how he perceives all these things that have happened and what things are going on to this day, and how they've affected him and how they've affected his family and how he sees them, out and about in the world. And I tell people all the time, it's like one of the luckiest things that's happened in my writing career and my life to have a chance to do this book with him. It's been honestly, it's been a blessing for me.
The tone of the book felt, I've been trying to find the right word, aggressive. Do you think he'd do this again? Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, no, I think it is. And, as a writer, I try not to be sensitive about reviews. But I saw that was kind of the theme of a lot of the reviews of the book, was that he came off almost too strongly and a little too harshly. And, I think maybe one or two might have said bitter. And I didn't necessarily think that was an accurate description.
No,
but
it wasn't bitter.
It is a word for it, because he's felt the things that have happened to him since then so deeply. He's felt, the grievances, he's felt the slights. He's noticed the people who he thought would be supportive of him not be supportive of him at a very vulnerable time in his life. And I think that's what sort of guided a lot of what was going on, because doing something like that, and there aren't many things like that that anyone has really ever done, but doing something like that makes you vulnerable.
Yeah.
Maybe as vulnerable as anyone ever really is. And, it means there's a whole lot of different ways that people can really cause you a lot of pain. And he felt that, in a lot of ways. And as tough as he is, I mean, you got to be tough to still be around, to be a black man and still be around 50 years after a moment like that. And it's kind of a miracle that they both are. And we should all be really thankful for that. And that goes for Harry Edwards as well, to be in that sort of a crucible that hot. But yeah, it leaves scars, but I think, and if I'm probably sort of heading toward the direction of the question you asked, he absolutely would do it again.
Okay.
He really, really has no regrets about doing that. He really felt that he was called to do it, that he could not turn down an opportunity to do it. And he is the first athlete that I had met, even at that point in my career, as a writer, somebody who would observe sports, to talk about the athlete's platform. And it's really sort of such a common phrase now. But, 15 years or so ago, when we really sort of got into the meat of writing this book, he used that phrase so often in reference to what they talked about in the 60s. that it all made sense, and it sort of became part of my vocabulary. Now I think, you know, not because of him necessarily, but it just is a part of everybody's vocabulary now. That platform as an athlete is really something special, you know, and as a celebrity in sort of the big picture, but specifically as an athlete, especially as a black athlete. And he feels that so deeply and so fundamentally that he absolutely would do it again. If he had the opportunity, he would advise anyone else to do it again. They would obviously have to be ready for whatever may come after it, though. But he absolutely believes in taking advantage of that every chance you get, because not many people are afforded something like that. And you can't just let the opportunity go by.
And to make sure we're 100% clear for people who haven't read this book, Silent Gesture, it is not bitter by any stretch of the imagination. It is aggressive, but and it's written like you can feel hurt, you can feel pain, you can feel betrayal in it, but you can feel anger in it. But in no way, shape, or form, at least in my reading of it, is there bitterness at all. I thought the book was extraordinary, and it taught me a lot about Tommy Smith, about someone that I thought I knew a lot about already. And to kind of put a bow on this, David, there's two different points, because I always love, because I love reading autobiographies. I love reading like what makes people tick. And, you know, there's a point leading into the 68 games, you know, perhaps at the race when you guys brilliantly describe his routine and the groin injury he has and all of that. And he's thinking to himself, I can't bring out my message if I don't win. And it took me back to a line earlier in the book when he started running track. And his dad said to him, you can start running, but if you finish second place, you're coming back and picking cotton. Yeah. And that was just the greatest tie-in in the world to me. And I left thinking, man, the motivation to win at different walks of his life, I just absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, that part really moved me too. And that's, you know, one of the real challenges as a writer to tell his story in his voice, and to just really not even embellish it, but just make it as if he's the guy just spilling all this out. And that is really genuinely who he was and how he became who he was. And I was you know, just enthralled by his description of that. And I wanted to make that a very prominent part of the book. And I think that, you know, he understood that pretty clearly because it was ground into him, you know, at a very early age. And that just sort of, again, plays up why family is so important to him, why, you know, the leadership of someone like a father is so important to him, why that sort of, camaraderie between family, friends, teammates, anyone who sort of comes together for a goal that's larger than themselves, and yet doesn't lose their individual selves. You know, how important that that really is. And it's a hint into, again, and this is something that I want to make sure was a big part of the book, is it's a window into what a great athlete he was. Because I don't want that to be forgotten.
Yeah.
And maybe one of the most fun things about doing the book was talking to his contemporaries, you know, his old teammates, his competitors, people we went to school with, people we grew up with, who talk so much about how great a runner he was and how they even learned from him how to become a better runner. And finding out how he became a great runner. And that was just a part of it, the motivation from his father.
Yeah.
And understanding the way that he grew up. Because I don't want that to be forgotten, because, you know, and this is the same thing that goes on again today. You know, we might not be listening to a lot of these players if they honestly were guys who were just on the practice squad or sitting at the end of the bench or something like that. Colin Kaepernick went to the Super Bowl. You know how great Eric Reid is. You know how good the Eagles are. The Eagles won a Super Bowl. The Seahawks won a Super Bowl with all these players who are outspoken, who aren't afraid to, you know, speak their minds. That was the case back then. You know, you were not going to get an opportunity to make your statement if you didn't win. I mean, if Tommy Smith somehow can't finish that race, you know, the entire history of this sport and of this country is different.
Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. And I wasn't around for the relevancy of this moment in 1968, but I am today. And I know it's incredibly relevant now. And you did a fantastic job in Silent Gesture of capturing the moment and everything that surrounds that moment, David. And I can't thank you enough for being so gracious with your time today, man. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh man, it's my pleasure. I'm grateful to you to find this anniversary as important and as relevant as you do to talk about it like this. I'm really thrilled about it.
That is David Steele. The book is called Silent Gesture. I hope you got as much out of that as I did. As I noted yesterday, and as we started here today with David, this is an event that I have just been absolutely enamored with for, you know, 30 years of my life or 20 something years of my life. I remember it first really drawing attention to it in, you know, the 1992 Olympics. I don't even know what the context was or how I saw it, but that's when I first noticed it. And you start asking a few questions and just an amazing moment. And obviously its relevancy here in 2018, as David and I just laid out there, can't be ignored. Again, the book is called Silent Gesture. David Steele wrote it with Tommy Smith. It is an incredible reader, an incredible listen. I hope you take the opportunity to check that out. And we aren't done this week. Karan J. Phillips is going to join me for the episode that drops on Thursday. And we're going to tie this all together. We're going to tie Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the events of the 60s together and how all of that impacts what's happening in sports today. Thank you so much for being with us. If you haven't subscribed yet, please hit the subscribe button. If you're a subscriber and you haven't rated us yet, if you could just hit the 5 stars on whatever platform you're using, whether it's Google Play or Apple Podcast, iTunes, whatever it may be, just hit the 5 stars. That helps us get noticed by other people outside our little circle here. I greatly appreciate it. If you want to connect, Damian Barling across all social media platforms, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. If you want to shoot me an email, you could do that as well. DamianBarling@me.com. Again, thank you so much to David Steele. Thank you so much for listening today. And come back. We'll do this again on Thursday.